Here is the Media Beat with David Tarasuk. David, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Well, I hope we're connected now, Marshall. I thought we were connected earlier, but we weren't. I hope we are now.
We are now. We're connected.
Oh, isn't that great? Good old-fashioned telephony, I think. Is that right?
Hey, you know what? It works. It's always there.
When in doubt, pick up the phone. Okay, I'm here. And I'm here in London. I was in a different part of Europe. Britain's still, for the moment, is part of Europe. But I come back to my old home country, the UK, as it struggles its way through to another general election, in which this time, more than anything else, the biggest issue is whether or not quite how to leave the European Union. And the election is now just 2 weeks away.
What's interesting is actually coming in this morning on Morning Edition, they were interviewing people from Northern Ireland, okay, and the southern part, and already there are tensions building up about that border on both sides. People are remembering what it was like at one time.
Well, of course, the resurrection of a hard border across the island of Ireland has been one of the issues at the heart of people's concern about Britain leaving the European Union, because both sides of that border have, for the last 30 years, they've counted themselves part of Europe. That will change when Britain leaves Europe, if that happens, and it looks absolutely as if there's very little to stop that happening now, although you never know, this general election in the UK might make a difference, though it's a very, very big might. So if the northern part of Ireland, because it's attached to the United Kingdom, leaves Europe, but the southern part of Ireland remains in, as it will, then of course you have a border, and border means customs posts, and all of that issue has been at the heart of a lot of wrangling in Britain's attempts to negotiate its way out. And I'm sure it's been hovering in the background. It's been very, very prominent for Irish people, as they consider this whole problem, but now the reality of it's coming in to bite people a bit more generally, and the generally applicable truth is beginning to emerge that two things, it's going to go one of two ways, each of which will upset an awful lot of people. If there's a border between Northern Ireland and the UK in order to ensure that there's ease of commerce between North and South Ireland, then that's infuriating to the hardline unionist community of Northern Ireland, unionist in the sense that they want to continue a complete union with the rest of the UK, England, Scotland and Wales. But if it goes the other way and you get anything like a real division drawn across the island, then you're going to infuriate the United Ireland cause, the very cause that kept what was known as the Troubles, the very violent upheaval in Ireland between the late 1960s and the very turn of the century, which has led to, finally, a peace agreement, which has held quite well for 20 years, but now is threatened by this revival of the idea of a hard border. Yeah. So yes, you've got that issue coming very much to the fore now that the reality is staring us in the face. Now, although the British government under Boris Johnson has tried to minimize that all the time during its negotiations, now we're staring at a very, very stark reality.
Now, that's another point that was being discussed, and that is you have the elections coming up, and really, no one sees a chance. Everybody looks like Boris Johnson and his party will gain control. Do you think it's going to be that big of a landslide?
It's very hard to tell. Remember that the last time there was an electoral test of opinion in the United Kingdom, all the pollsters got it wrong. All the pollsters except one. And that's rather significant. That one very successful pollster, known as YouGov, and operating on the basis of a very large sample survey and a particular kind of analysis, which takes full account of the effect of individual constituencies and the way that they can weight the system in a first-past-the-post electoral system, which is what ours is normally called. In Britain, it's a similar kind of skew or tilt, if you like, that the Electoral College can affect on the United States presidential election. So it's an important thing to take into account. And this time, this particular poll is suggesting now, 2 weeks away from the poll, the actual polling day, that Boris Johnson stands to get a very large majority out of this election. Most polls are suggesting that he's probably going to win. It's a volatile electorate, of course, as it is in many parts of Europe and indeed the United States right now. But most of them are predicting a majority for Johnson, but sometimes they tilt the other way. In fact, the same poll once registered quite contrary findings within 10 days of each testing. But the one important one, which I want to stress now, because it was so successful last time, is this YouGov poll, which suggests that he may have hundreds of seats in the new parliament out of the 600 or so total. So this might well be his route to a kind of triumphant victory. Not very good news for the Labour Party, which backed this poll finally in the end, thinking that they might have a chance of wresting the prime ministership from Boris Johnson. But it doesn't look like it's going to be that way.
Is it more of an anti-vote than a vote for Boris Johnson?
Oh, it's being described now in the British media, and I think they know exactly what they're talking about, since this is the coin of the realm in which they deal. They say it's basically an unpopularity contest. People are basically making up their minds about which is the least unpopular of those two leaders.
Well, just remember when the last time an election like that was held in the United States, what happened.
Well, yeah, exactly. The same might be said of this one.
Oh, gosh, it's amazing times that we do live in.
And of course, and feelings are running very high, especially in the media community. At the moment, the biggest concern is that an extraordinary innovation took place last night in UK time, which was the TV network that I used to work for when I lived here, Channel 4, known generally speaking as a sort of forward-looking network. It has as part of its statutory obligation the idea of producing innovative programming. Can you imagine a television network charged by law to be innovative? Anyway, that's what Channel 4 is, and they had planned last night the very first ever electoral debate live on TV, nationally broadcast, devoted entirely to environmental issues, to climate change, essentially, as its main focus. And they had the plan was to have the leader of every party, and if you count the small parties, that means seven party leaders sitting in a television studio discussing what is regarded, certainly by Channel 4, and by a lot of media commentators, so was the main issue at the heart of this election. Every country's election right now, because it's such an important global issue, overtaking even the Brexit issue here. And guess what? The Prime Minister of the country declined to show up. it went an interesting way thereafter. The network said, well, we want leaders. There's no leader of this party. We're going to show an empty chair. And then the Conservative Party, Boris Johnson's party, deputized, if you like, another member of the government, Michael Gove. You may remember that name. He was the man who ran against Boris Johnson within the Conservative Party for the leadership, but he was very quickly dispatched and Boris Johnson won. Now he's a loyal supporter and did his duty. He showed up at the doors of the Channel 4 network only to be turned away because the member said, "I'm sorry, this debate is for leaders only." I mean, the empty chair had, and this has been decried by Boris Johnson himself as a terrible political stunt, on the chair that he was supposed to have occupied, they placed an ice sculpture, in fact a globe of the world, which proceeded to melt as the program went on, of course, for an hour or so broadcast time. Fuels are running high, let's put it that way.
All right, it should be interesting. I was just thinking it was probably an anti-Corbyn effect, kind of like the DNC, even though it's not an election in this country. And now, through former President Barack Obama, really have come, it's out and out war against the progressive wing of the party, which is led by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And you can maybe say Mayor Pete, but I doubt it, because he's becoming more centrist as it goes. But it's very interesting to see the divisions now blow up completely in the Democratic Party. It's the Democratic Party.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not dissimilar here. The Labour Party in opposition in their terms far too long now, and continuing to fail to make inroads against the Conservatives. Leadership in the government. They're having their splits too. All parties, it has to be said, in Great Britain and Northern Ireland are split on the Europe issue. But there are, of course, the other basic issues as well. And in the Labour Party, there's a very similar split to the one you're describing amongst the Democrats. And for many reasons to do with what in both countries is called electability, there's a lot of concern about what many would regard as particularly leftist trends in the party. And along with that, the decidedly shaming dimension in the Labour Party of an upsurge of ill-disguised anti-Semitism, which has given the Labour Party another issue to feel split over. And whether or not the leadership in the shape of Jeremy Corbyn has taken good care, at least, care to expunge the traces of anti-Semitism which have been asserting themselves again in the last few years. And Jeremy Corbyn's having his trouble with his own troops because of that. It's all a very messy political situation. And as I say, add that to the unpleasantly high and coarsening temperature of high temperature and coarseness of exchange. You get a very messy situation and a very nasty, the beginnings of a very nasty last 2 weeks of this campaign.
During which I would say nobody has spent as much money as Michael Bloomberg did last week.
Well, of course not. There's a lot of money being spent in Britain, but that's only speaking comparatively. Our elections are nowhere near as expensive to run as they are in the United States. The kind of numbers that Bloomberg is throwing around would be regarded as totally astronomical here.
$35 million in his first buy, and basically what they said is that is 1% of his net worth. So just imagine the money that he can throw around that nobody else can throw around.
That's one media buy, and of course, in the case of the United States elections, we're a year away now. So imagine the expenditure between now and November 7th next year.
Which really, of course, wouldn't offend an electorate, right? Why should it?
Well, I was just going to get to say I'm offended simply because it's an unfair advantage. But when you're wealthy, you have that unfair advantage.
I'm not talking about him. Oh, sorry. Okay.
Just let me finish first here. But I actually saw two of his commercials, and they're very well done. Very centrist, shows his the liberal side of him, not the conservative side of him. And what I shake my head at, and this is where the Democratic National Committee gets it all wrong, the ads are not going to affect the support for Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. Those ads are going to affect the support for Joe Biden. They're going to draw people from.
That's the whole idea.
From Joe Biden, but it's a big mistake. It's a huge mistake. And it's funny. It's funny because $35 million for an initial buy sounds like a lot of money.
No, it's $39 for him essentially.
Yeah, but
it's nothing.
Yeah,
but can I just?
Yeah.
The thing that gets me is that I don't understand what obviously the DNC is trying to come up with someone to counter the progressive wing of the party, and they apparently don't feel as though they've got what they want. And got someone who can take that on. So I don't know how that ends up resonating with an actual person who doesn't live in New York, LA, or in a major media market. That's what I don't know.
Well, there's an answer to that provided by Britain, which is may not be a particularly palatable one for an American audience, but. Here, the electoral contest is between two established leaders. The idea of selecting your leader just at the very time when you go into an election strikes the British audience as very peculiar. You know, they've got their two leaders. It's a parliamentary system, and that's essentially what makes the difference. Here, you have the two parties constantly. In opposition to each other. It's a basic principle of democratic parliamentary democracy, democratic parliamentary procedure that you have the forces, as you get in Congress, set out in a polarity across the building, government on one side, governing party on one side, and the opposition party on the other side. And you already have an established challenger in the leadership of the opposition. The idea of having to sort out in the last run towards the electoral day who exactly you're going to battle with as your leader strikes the Brits as very peculiar and almost bound to create an inbuilt disadvantage for the challenger.
Not to mention the fact that it doesn't do anything for the three branches of government. Just in terms of presentation, it doesn't do much for the three branches of government.
The obvious argument for it, of course, is that it's also highly democratic. I mean, it is a lot more democratic than the British system. You do actually give people the chance. You widen the possibilities for who the ultimate leading challenger should be. Which in some ways is a very fine principle, but in practical terms, it leads to an innate disadvantage for the challenging party.
And the other complication...
They have to sort themselves out internally before they go into battle, whereas that decision about who's going to lead you is usually a given choice already made in the case of the incumbent.
And then when you have an unpopularity contest the way that you describe in UK, what does the party leader does the party leader that does not get elected do they carry on, or is there usually some?
If you take a bite of the cherry and then end up not getting anything as a result of it, then yes, of course, the ultimate price you pay in politics is dismissal. That has been the you fall upon your sword is the tradition here, and that's happened again and again in the case of the Labour Party. And of course, it happened even in the case of the Conservative Party when they retained office, but so narrowly that it was so embarrassing. For instance, David Cameron, the the bright younger thing of a prime minister who decided to have a referendum about membership of Europe. You remember that?
I do, and I'm still baffled at who thought that was a good idea. Why? That just seemed insular.
Well, the pollsters supported him. I'm afraid there was a reading of the British opinion that didn't prove to be accurate enough to warrant the decisions that were made.
Yeah, and again, with polling, as people are finally, just as with the internet, as people are suddenly beginning to realize, gee, not everything out there is true. And the problem with polling is it totally, completely depends on who you ask. And the assumption, and you've mentioned this myriad times, about the echo chamber and how people just start hearing what they think they should hear. And, you know, you've got that. You didn't, it's unlikely that you saw this yesterday, but the occupant of the Oval Office went to Afghanistan.
We're aware of that, yes. A British reaction common across the media generally, regardless of its political stripe, is that only now, almost 3 years into his office, isn't that a little late in the day to be doing this? But that's the kind of expectancy that the Brits tend to have of leadership, which perhaps Americans don't have. I don't know.
The point being that in the I can't remember which network first put it out, but in their news story, the third paragraph was an apology. They had to not cover. They had to say that for his security, they couldn't. They had to promise not to report that he wasn't going to be in Florida. And I just...
As with every president, yes.
Of course. And this is the Apple Watch is like, oh, we're really sorry we had to... Like, we were bound by the constraints of the security of every president. I mean, for crying out loud, it just seemed a bit sad. That's all.
Hardly worth saying, also.
That's what I mean. It's just that you don't have to.
You either report it or you don't report it. You don't report it and apologize for doing it the way that you're doing it.
Because that's the way you have to do it.
Well, you know why they did that, right? Why they do that?
So is that to appear supportive?
No, because the White House issued a press release scalding one newspaper which had reported what he was going to be doing on Thanksgiving. And it was a generic report, you know, Thanksgiving, the White House, blah, 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 blah. The White House came out and just blasted saying fake news, fake news, fake news. That's why all the other media outlets are saying we didn't cover it because that happened.
Which was the outlet that did that?
I forget which one, but it was just a typical Thanksgiving, you know. Okay,
yeah,
throw that in, blah, blah. It's a blah, blah, generic story. Turkeys, you know, pardoning turkeys, stuff like that. And, of course, it was totally wrong.
They went to the golf course, I know that.
But of course, it was totally wrong because he went where he went. But that's why they came out. So that's why the other networks have come out so vociferous, saying, look, we didn't know. When they just, you know, they have to separate themselves in this day of
conflation
attacks by everybody, not just the president of the United States, but by everybody. And so they were separating themselves and That's why that happened.
Okay.
When everything's a battlefield, you have to take a position, it seems. Yeah.
Right, but not everybody knows that. I mean, and that's what's even more alarming, because you just once you get down to just the retail consumer, I saw that, oh, I saw this,
Well, people don't realize about media, and we only have a couple of minutes left, but people don't realize about media, and I always find it amazing when somebody famous dies and they pop up the obituary on TV and they talk about it right away. These things are all their stories as a media. Hey, when I go into the weekend, I have stories that I've picked out that are going to be part of my newscast for Saturday, Sunday, and into Monday, just in case nothing big happens. And I don't think people realize this about newspapers and about media in general, is that if you're smart, you always have something on the standby in case nothing happens that you can fill the time that you're meant to fill.
And that's really part of the business, in the same way that we're talking about the business of politics. I'm not just talking about the cash. It's like, no, you run your constituency and you have to represent your constituency. And of course, not all constituencies are the same. People don't have the same issues depending on where you go.
Absolutely. And the media has to be prepared for things that they have planned for, and always the possibility of the best laid plans of mice and men going awry, and that's why there's such a thing as fallback and backup arrangements, and when the structure, when the scaffolding is exposed, it's not as if it's some great some great horrendous revelation. It's just a peek behind the curtain, as it were. And I think most sophisticated consumers of media know that. But they may have to be reminded, of course, that that's what's going on when there's a mismatch between the conventionally planned information that's out on a particular day compared to what turns out to be the reality that needs to be reported.
Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.